netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. In this week's podcast, Mike Seymour is going to have an interview with Zoic about the visual effects for a new Fox TV show called Drive. But before we start, let me bring you up to date on some FX Guide projects. First, NAB is coming up real soon. We'll be doing nightly podcasts, including kicking off Sunday night live from the Autodesk party after the users group meeting. I also want to briefly mention we're starting the new FX PhD term soon, which you can check out the course listings on the site, fxphd.com. A couple of courses I'm really interested in this term. There's a character drawing and development class, an After Effects design class, a Photoshop CS3 class. This in addition to Shake, Maya, there's a whole bunch of classes. You really should check a look at the list. And also, there'll be two Flame classes this term, including, for the first time, we're offering a Flame 101 class, a beginner's Flame class. We've been asked a lot about this, and this term we're going to offer, for the first time, this 101 class. Also, the Background Fundamentals class is detailed on the webpage, and you can see we're going to be doing a stunt shoot. It looks like a very exciting term, so I encourage you to check out fxphd.com. Okay, let's join Mike, who's going to talk to Lonnie Parastir, visual effects supervisor on Drive from Zoic. Zoic has a very long credit list in visual effects for episodic TV, and this new Fox show called Drive looks wild. Mike discusses with Lonnie a wide range of things, including some really cool techniques they developed to do visual effects for this show. Let's join that interview now.
And Lonnie, thanks for joining us from Los Angeles. I know you're incredibly busy at the moment.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you guys, I'm going to have to get into the history of some. I want to talk to you about Drive because I think it's a really exciting project, but I have to get into some of the history of the company because you guys have been kicking it big time. I mean, your credit list has just been awesome.
We've been very fortunate, and I think that it really stems from, you know, kind of a commitment among a lot of the principals here to just constantly try to bring innovative visual effects and techniques in visual effects to television. You know, we really wanted to treat television in an A level and basically express ourselves in a big way on the small screen. We kind of push the feature television model to a great extent because we believe that with the right people, with the right vision and the right focus, it is possible to achieve extraordinary things with today's software, today's budgets, and today's schedules. You just have to focus and just have to get it going.
So you guys have done, well, let me just list a couple of them because you're probably too modest to do it, but tell me if I get any of these wrong, but Buffy, Firefly, Serenity, Angel, Battlestar Galactica, 24. I mean, these are hardcore episodic effects programs. That's a pretty impressive lineup. I probably missed a couple as well.
over the 4.5 years that we've been in business, you know, we've worked on almost 50 television series, in most of the big ones. And we've had, you know, kind of a significant creative role, you know, from whether it's Battlestar Galactica or CSI, you know,
completely missed CSI.
Yes. I mean, we've kind of run around the gamut of what is great in visual effects. I think that, we've been very fortunate, for example, to, have been in on the ground floor of really innovative sort of first-time television series that have first-time, you know, levels of high-end visual effects quality, you know, starting really with the series finale of Buffy, you know, which incorporated, you know, massive type shots. When I say massive, I mean like we had hundreds of thousands of vampires attacking Buffy and on TV, and we also challenged ourselves and, you know, to do new techniques in CGI with Firefly. We developed what, you know, I call the, you know, practical camera effects in CG that have become, you know, now so popular even in feature films. We were able to author, you know, the rules for CG photography, you know, coming into this, you know, into the 2000s. You know, it's great to have been, you know, part of that because Joss Whedon and Tim Minear, who created Firefly, really were open to the idea that, you know, they wanted to see something different in CGI. So Zoic was positioned in year one to develop this way of, you know, photographing CG. And you know, basically what Chris Jones, my partner, and I wanted to do with the new rules in CG is we wanted to say, look, CG rules have to follow photographic rules that happen in real life. And therefore, when they do follow those rules, they will feel more realistic. And what does that mean? We say, well, all of our CG cameras are mounted somewhere. All of our CG cameras have a focus to pull. All of our CG cameras have a zoom lens that they can use. All of our CG cameras are lenses and therefore have artifacts and flaws in which the images can be affected, whether positive or negative, by those flaws. In addition to that, you know, we have camera operators who are human beings that don't, you know, make shots perfect every single time they shoot a shot. And that was what was great about Firefly, is Joss was like, I love that. That's going to make everybody feel like they're looking at something that's organic and real. So that's what we did. And so coming out of the gate year one, we won the Emmy, and, you know, it was really great because we didn't have that many credits. We were only doing Firefly and Buffy and Angel, which were all Joss shows. Joss was, you know, very much a creative partner for me. And I've been working with him for 8 years or 7 years at the time. And so, you know, to come out of the gate with that, with just a bunch of, you know, a really passionate guys who wanted to create new rules, you know, we were able to kind of fall into other great projects. You know, it was because of Firefly that Ron Moore and David Icke and Michael Reimer knocked on our door and said, hey guys, we've got this miniseries called Battlestar Galactica that we're doing with Sci-Fi Channel. You know, we really like what you do in Firefly. You know, can you do that for us? I know that show was canceled, but we would like to give you the opportunity to really go nuts because that is the style that we want for the show. And we said, great. We felt like we didn't get to sort of finish out our exploration. You know, we took it into the miniseries and season one and season two, and you know, had a really good time. And then Battlestar became such a huge hit. I mean, what's so awesome is that those kinds of shows necessarily give you the freedom because the creators are so excited about what the creative artists at Zoic are doing, that they give us the freedom to be innovative artists and creators in our own right, so that we can make some exceptional work. And, you know, obviously it was, you know, Battlestar and Firefly are space shows, and you know, they don't correlate to CSI, but even CSI, the reason why, you know, Jerry Bruckheimer and his crew, Danny Cannon and company, came to us and met Andrew Orloff, who's their visual effects supervisor, is because they wanted to bring an organic quality to the cinema that they were doing in their visual effects. They wanted to, you know, not have everything look like a CG effect, but rather an organic effect that is story-driven. And if there's anything that I've learned in my lifetime of working with Joss Whedon, is that the greatest visual effects come from precision-focused storytelling. All effects are derivative of the story. And so, you know, that's really kind of been what's propelled the company forward. And, you know, all the other credits that we've done, whether we've, you know, worked on the biggest pilots from, you know, Drive to Lost in Space to the Sarah Connor Chronicles, which is what we're doing now. We're making the Terminator for TV. And I'm telling you, the T-888, when people get to see this, they're going to die. It looks fantastic. It's just that, the you know, good opportunity and great projects kind of propel people to work harder. Everybody here, you know, now we were 12 people when we started. Today we're, you know, 100 and I think we're 117 today down in Los Angeles, and in our Vancouver office we're, you know, up to about, you know, 36 or 37. So it's because they get to work on great product and they kind of push themselves forward, and we, because they're excited about what they're working on.
Now I think Battlestar Galactica really brought your work to a wide audience because, you know, Firefly was in many respects, by most critics, unreasonably cancelled. But what was interesting, though, and you touched on it there yourself, is that a lot of that history came from doing television programs. I mean, the guys from Battlestar Galactica were ex-Star Trek, so that there's a lot of history there of coming from a world that isn't grounded in the everyday life. CSI hits that, but only hits it in the lab. I guess what I want to draw you to is now with Drive, that is in no way a sci-fi show. In no way could you characterize Drive as it's. I mean, I jokingly referred to it as Smokey and the Bandit meets Lost and Google Maps. But
yeah, have you seen the pilot?
I've seen parts of it, and it hasn't aired, and I think that the thing about it, though, is that it's not, you know, it's not set in space, it's not set with, and so I'd be interested to get your thoughts on that move now to, because Drive, while it isn't a effects sci-fi thing, is a very hardcore effects show because of the constraints of production.
That's right. And in Drive, you know, in my very short career in visual effects has been not only the most challenging, but the most fulfilling project that I've ever been a part of, because it forced Zoic and our production team to come up with solutions that are at face value not effect solutions, with effect solutions to overcome production limitations and to come up with another sort of new creative idea for photographing material that hasn't been done before. Drive, you know, so the coolest thing about Drive is the Drive has a Drive shot, which is a Drive effect shot. And when you see it, you won't see it. You'll just see something happen and you won't know how it happened. It'll just happen, and you won't know why or how it could possibly happen. It just does. And it's a photographic effect that is invisible to the realm of effects because it doesn't look like effects. It just looks like driving shot in a very interesting way. And I'll get into that a little bit. But to come back to it, you know, it's you know, what it is the Drive effect that we've come up with for the show is the exact opposite of what we did on Battlestar Galactica. In Battlestar, we created organic rules for CG cameras that are photographing non-realistic things. On Drive, we created an omniscient camera that our audiences are maybe familiar with through their video game camera, a camera that omnisciently follows the action, that looks at what the story is doing, but doesn't invade it, but rather observes it without intrusion, an omniscient camera that does not cut. And we put this omniscient camera in the middle of 65-mile-an-hour car chases. For several minutes. So the omniscient camera comes in and out of vehicles, looks at characters in the context of a race, sees a dramatic action which causes them to take action. Those characters then move out of our camera, and we fall into the next piece of action and the next racer without cutting. So we have an omniscient eye that is completely placed within a photographic realism. So there's no apparent visual effect. It just looks like the camera's moving around on a highway.
So let's discuss that for a second, because the program doesn't go to air until Sunday the 15th. I mean, how does it compare, for example, to the circular camera move in War of the Worlds that ILM did on the car?
That's a great sort of like kind of tipping point, because when Tim called up last November and said, hey, I got the show with Ben Queen and we're going to do it, and it's a show that's about a car race from Florida to somewhere, we don't know where, but the whole thing takes place on the road and I can't take the actors to the road, and not only that, but I don't want to do it unless I can do something really unique. He goes, did you see that War of the Worlds movie? And did you see that shot where, you know, ILM had the camera kind of flying around the minivan? He goes, how do they do that? And I said, well, it's a combination of things, but mainly it's shot on stage with actors on a green screen, and they've created a virtual psych, a background that they're able to move around. He said, well, that's really cool and all, but how do I do that, and how do I move from car to car to car to car? And that's where it went, I don't know. I don't think anybody's ever done that before. Well, I guess we just have to figure that out. And I really didn't have the answer, and nor did you know any of the guys I worked with. It was just sort of, actually, I got a lot of these doe-eyed looks. Well, hey, you know, the one in War of the Worlds worked because it was, you know, a fixed idea. It was a technocrane moving around a car, and it's a fixed space, so we could figure that out because it's a fixed thing. And I'm saying, well, what if it wasn't fixed? What if it always changed all the time? How do you figure that out? And, you know, again, you're looking at a room full of very talented people, and they sit there and they go, I don't know. You know, and some of the most talented are saying, oh, you're going to have too many problems. You don't want to do that. You're going to have focal length issues. You're going to have depth of field issues. You're going to have motion blur issues. You're going to have all these things. You can't do it in CG. You can't do it in play photography because nothing will match. And you know, so you have a lot of like that going on. And, you know, here I am like with the guy in the back of the room. I says, I know that that's what the challenges we have are. I know those are the challenges we have to face. But I just want to try. You know, let's just try.
Let me interrupt you there. Before you tell us how you got to it, let's just identify a couple of the key ways that something might be approached, because that'll set up the problem better. I mean, if we have a nodal pan inside a vehicle, then we can obviously shoot, and it's been done several times with multiple cameras. Sometimes I'll shoot, like, I don't know, 6 HD cameras, and that will give them a virtual psych. And, of course, a nodal pan, there's no parallax shift, so as I pan left, pan right, I just pan the background left and right, and nothing need move in parallax. At the other end of the spectrum, there's an entire digital environment where it's a completely digital, completely synthetic world, and you can fly a camera anywhere you want. Now, your problem, I presume, was to sit somewhere in the middle of those two without the expense of the last one but without the restrictions of the first one. Would that be a fair summary?
That is correct. And we
How the heck did you do it?
Yeah, so how the heck did we do it? Well, it was coming up with the sort of the half version of that. You know, we basically took a look at what a 7-camera psych on a nodal point would give us in terms of realistic visuals outside of all the windows to free up the camera to move around. And we just determined within a 3D camera where the nodal pan would fall apart and we would lose all sense of perspective. And that, you know, basically happens in the sort of a car length zone around the vehicle, right? So it's when the car is directly behind the vehicle. It's, you know, it's essentially 15 feet or something like that. And beyond 15 feet, you can move around the context of the vehicle without running into parallax problems. You only run into it when another vehicle comes in that next lane, either on either side. That being said, we said, okay, well, when we have cars that are moving in that lane, we have to do one of a couple of things. We either have to create that vehicle in CG, or we have to shoot it on the stage next to the vehicle, and we have to be able to move that vehicle as if it were on the road. So we will have to come up with a solution that will allow us to move that car in an organic way that will feel like it's on the road and not, you know, being pushed on a sled. And that was like the first set of situations. And then on top of that, you know, where the depth of field falls apart because we're using, you know, a 21-millimeter lens, we're going to have to hand rotoscope layers within that lens so that we can match the lenses that we're going to use to float around. So if we're on a 40-millimeter lens, guess what? We got to roto out the cars that are in the second lane and in the and that are more than 15 feet away so that we can hold a depth of field and a depth that is true to the lens that we're using. Not only that,
just to pick up on that, so you're shooting wider than you need, and
that's
what you're
correct.
Saying is because it's wider, you have a huge amount of depth of field.
That's
so,
right.
So now, what is what's the pipeline there? Because on set, you're shooting on what format, and then how's that transferred, and what's the resolution?
So on location, you know, we use Previs extensively, like all good visual effects technicians do, and we determine what lenses we're going to use in order to get in and out of the vehicles to complete the shots that we want to see as we see them. And once we know that, we kind of do the good technician thing to do, which is we track those lenses. We look at those lenses on a grid so we can see what distortion we're going to achieve and what focus and depth of field we're going to find as our sort of restrictions or benefits. Then we, you know, came up with that nodal rig that you're discussing, which is a multi-camera rig that uses mirrors that allows us to bundle, you know, quite a number of cameras together. So we chose to put 7 cameras together, you know, on a fixed nodal point, shooting into mirrors, which gave us a 220-degree cyclorama. It kind of looks like, you know, the wonderful world of Disney where you've got that grand room where you can look all around you and you've got something to look at. That freed up the camera to kind of pan around inside the vehicle and float, you know, within the limitations of the lens. So that being said, the 21-millimeter lens is a wider lens. It's got more distortion. So we had to unwrap that lens, you know, using tools that we set up in both combustion and After Effects to unwrap those lenses. And then we had to repaste, you know, sort of reclip them together, restitch them together in their new unwarped phase, you know, unwarped mode. And then we had to hand rotoscope, you know, the cars that kind of broke the line of depth of field based on the, you know, what we gathered in our prep work to understand what we needed to see in the previous phase.
And is the capturing of the principal photography with the actors and or the digital 220-degree, is that film or digital or HD or something?
Today it's film, but, you know, we're testing away. We want, you know, the problem with digital is that it falls apart in the mirror. So, you know, there's too much resolution loss at this particular moment. So we have high hopes that the red camera will solve that issue because the plates would be certainly a heck of a lot nicer, you know, if we could get them in HD.
So then now we've got the theoretical psych, and
yep.
You've got your understanding of depth of field and understanding what your real camera would do. But
yep.
We still haven't solved our problem of how to move those vehicles or how to solve the breaking the nodal point.
So when we break the nodal point, we necessarily have to insert other kinds of sort of methodologies to solve those problems. So when we have cars that are coming into the neighboring lane or up behind us directly, we needed to actually have those vehicles physically on the stage, on the green screen psych, so that the perspective would be realistic. So in order to do that, we need to be able to match the motion that we would see visibly, you know, on the road. So necessarily what that means is we shoot all the action on the road first. So we have our blocking. So it's almost like the master shot is complete and we know exactly where all the cars and what time and how they get there. Then, you know, we can't do motion control because, you know, we need to do extraordinary moves that motion control arms can't do. So you use the technocrane. So what we do on the stage, is on the green screen, is we're using a technocrane that, you know, frames things just a little bit wider, and we use camera operators that are just, you know, just in the zone of the actual, you know, action that we did on location. And then we have cars that are on 6.5-foot casters, air casters, that are elevated above the stage floor on melamine. And these air casters hover, like hovercraft. And Matt Sweeney, who everybody knows and loves, and he's one of the greatest special effects, you know, coordinators in the business, feature films or otherwise, you know, he came up with these air casters which allow us to move the vehicles as if they were on ice. So what that means is that 6.5 feet to 8 feet off the ground, we can then physically move the cars with people at great rates of speed. If we can't get that rate up high enough, we were able to attach cables and stop points so that we can. So what you get is you get people that are literally hand-pushing vehicles to match footage that we've shot on location so that as we cross a mullion into that no zone, which we call the dead space, which is where the nodal dies, we transition from a live-action car on location to a live-action car on the stage and then back again as it passes through.
Wow.
And all of that is then seen together because now we're on stage and we're in green screen and box lighting with outdoor, you know, direct sunlight. That's all seen together using extensive CG. So basically we have a CG vehicle for every vehicle that's involved in this action, and we lay over top of that with reflection maps and specular passes that we step on each vehicle with so that those transitions carry through.
So now you already mentioned that you're using combustion and After Effects. What are you doing the 3D in?
We actually spread the work out a little bit. You know, we are modeling in Modo, you know, which we find, you know, is a wonderful tool, and then we bring that into Maya, and we do our animation in Maya, and then we port over to Lightwave 9, you know, which has been, you know, a wonderful thing for Zoic because it's an inherent renderer. You know, we render it as perfect, you know, for our heavy metal that we're doing. So we're able to get, you know, incredibly photorealistic Lightwave renders. And, you know, with the benefit of Nine's new motion blur patches, you know, we no longer have to worry about edge blurs that break up when we get into vectors.
That really has nailed that motion blur problem, hasn't it? It's a huge advantage.
It's really all of a sudden, you know, pushed that renderer, you know, into heavy competition with Mental Ray and RenderMan, so we don't have to do it, you know, at quite the price point. We can actually get photorealistic results, you know, with ray tracing and subdivision and all the bells and whistles with real, you know, with great motion blur. So it's pretty exciting. So that's how that goes through. So we render those elements out. So what the compositor gets is the compositor gets a live-action plate, they get a green screen with bad lighting, and they get a bunch of CG that kind of blends the two things together. And, you know, the other thing I didn't mention is that when we're on the green screen stage, obviously there's no reflections and there's no true highlight. The only thing we're matching is the sun position, you know, which we get from the plate. So the sun position is right, but, you know, we got box lights and camera crews and rigs and all kinds of things in the car. So every car necessarily has to be tracked and cleaned up in 3D, and we have to render out passes to step on each car, including
those
glass.
Are the three things. Yeah, the three things I was going to ask you about. Firstly, is cleaning up reflections in vehicles because they're notoriously bad for picking up anything that you don't want to see.
Yeah.
And is that just how do you actually do that? Is there anything special there, or is it just hard work?
It's you know, we're using again 3D. It's, you know, it's not quite O-flow, you know, but it's like, you know, sort of on the way to that, you know, because what we're doing is we're capturing the image in Buju, and then we're, you know, we're tracking a 3D model of the vehicle over top of the actual model, and we're rendering out reflection, specular, highlight, and all the traditional beauty passes that you get, you know, in a car render, and we're giving those to the compositor to use as a paint back. You know, they just use what they need and throw away what they don't.
Okay, so if there was, say, a muscle car coming up outside the pickup, you would actually replace the muscle car from the green scene stage, but you would be using the actors inside it and their spatial relationships, but the actual car that was shot on the stage doesn't get used. Is that right?
Well, it doesn't, because, you know, if you had to replace the whole dang thing, you know, it would require a lot more work. So we use, you know, a lot of the interior, and we use, you know, a lot of the shape. I mean, you know, the compositor really just has the ability to kind of kiss in the 3D. It doesn't have to,
right,
you know, totally live on its own. So you keep a lot of the vehicle. You know, it's a 3D roto, but it's also, you know, it also, you know, it's a part of the comp. There's something very visceral about it. And I tell you, when you put the, you know, the all CG cars work fine, but like there's something really neat about the, you know, the physicality of the real car, you know, next to the.
And I'm sure that helps the actors as well.
Yeah, especially too, because you get true shadows, right? You know, you get true, you know, reflections from car to car. So that stuff you keep. You don't want to lose that, because you've got, you know, the Mustang next to the pickup, and the pickup is reflecting in the Mustang, and you want to keep that. And that's just it.
The second thing I was going to say is tracking, because obviously a huge amount of tracking is required. Are you just doing markers on green screen, or is there anything special there to help with the tracking?
Because there's so much tracking involved in the show, we actually spot it on a per-shot basis. You know, we have depth tracking, so we have, you know, created, you know, specced out green sticks in the background that are built to a certain, you know, length with a certain amount of, you know, they're green sticks, like they're a variant of the digital green that we use in the background with, you know, a very strong keyable pink, you know, that these pink lines are sort of positioned at known distances from each other. And, you know, we looked at those and we built them because we found that Buju liked them, and that gives us our kind of exterior parallax. And then on the interior, you know, we use these tiny little Buju-friendly white squares with black triangles, and those get placed basically to camera. So we do a rehearsal, we take a look at what the camera's doing, and then we place them in as few spots as possible, you know, where, you know, the 3D trackers will have enough information to do their job.
And the last point I was going to ask you about is, given that you're doing the whole point is that the actors don't leave the production office, they travel across the country, however.
Yeah.
You've got the 220 degree cyclorama, but are you doing HDRs or any kind of advanced stuff there to give you reflection passes? Yep.
Yep. In fact, every time we go out on location and we shoot backgrounds, we do full-blown HDR captures. We bring those back so that we can, you know, do true lighting on the vehicles. That's absolutely what we do.
And, so this would all be...
And not only that, but we also, like, you know, a lot of the stunts are done, you know, in locations in Los Angeles, but they're not Florida or Georgia or Tennessee. So what we do is we also send a very small, you know, still photography unit, you know, with, you know, HDR Kaiden lenses, and we go out and we get HDRs, you know, in those areas, and we do a lot of establishing work where we say, you know, we set the scene, and we do some heavy digital matte painting for that.
And I was going to say, this is a really substantial effort, but if it was a substantial effort for a feature film, it would seem doable, but a substantial effort for an episodic with week-in, week-out effects just seems extraordinary.
About 130 visual effect shots per episode.
On a
pattern budget, you know, of $100,000, you know, and really that's what it is.
When you say a pattern budget, what do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is, you know, per episode we have, you know, $100,000 to do 130 shots.
Wow.
So,
because I was going to ask you how you budgeted, because it seemed to me that if somebody's doing a show, obviously if it's been going for a while, you could get a pattern, but it's like, well, I don't actually know yet what the scriptwriters are going to write, but I have to budget out this show, so, you know, what do I do?
So, you know, because of the nature of the show, you know, we're on episode 6, and, you know, the pattern, you know, completely fluxes, right? It jumps all over the place because, you know, the scripts are different and changing. So what a pattern budget does is it says, this is what we are approved to do, you know, for the visual effects component of our show. Doesn't necessarily constrain the writers, except if we can't take that money from other departments if we go over, or if we go under, you know, maybe we want to add something. So this
is a show. Can you sort of swap between episodes there? I mean, can you say, like, we're going to do a light episode because we're going to have a crash here?
Yeah, you have to. I mean, that's the only way, exactly. So we've got a crash coming up in episode 4, and we got to, you know, or we've got to save for that, or, you know, we've got a short post schedule on episode 6, so we can't really have a lot of work in there, you know, so we talk about that and we figure it out. So that helps a lot. And, you know, Tim, you know, having been involved in visual effects shows, heavy visual effects shows, it allows us to be a little bit smarter about what we're doing.
Now, before you started Zoic, you were at for a time at Digital Magic, and they did a lot of episodic television. In particular, they did Trek. And I know that Star Trek used to do A and B teams, so they could run basically get twice the duration per episode that the other departments did because they would be checkerboarding. Do you do that, and is there anything from your Digital Magic days that you still carry forward?
Definitely. I mean, Digital Magic was a unique place in the sense that, you know, we had, you know, upwards of 12 or 15 projects that were running at once, you know, sort of the cornerstone project being Star Trek, you know, and my particular project over there was Buffy. But, you know, we had a lot of projects going on that was being split up by a lot of different people. But there was actually, at the sort of creative level, there was really Ralph Myers, and I was the producer. You know, I mean, that was kind of how small that was, and there was a lot of creative teams that were hired out as vendors. You know, Don Greenberg and Hall and Greg Rainoff, who were on the Trek team, were working with, like, as you said, the Star Trek teams. Now, the Star Trek teams, you know, are, you know, Dan Curry being at the head of that, and then Ron Moore and Mitch Susskind being, you know, on his team with, you know, a number of other people, David Takamura, et cetera. Like, the way that they sort of produced in the hopscotch effort, I found was absolutely brilliant. In fact, as Drive gets going, you know, we're actively seeking to do that. We did, episode 1 was done with one producer here at Zoic, with one coordinator here at Zoic, while episode 2 was done by another. Because this is a first-year show, you know, as the show's visual effects supervisor, it's my intention to stay, you know, with the show, at least, you know, throughout the first 13 from a creative standpoint, and author all of them. Just, you know, it's a lot of work, but at the same time, I want to make sure that, you know, that nobody notices the visual effects in the show. I mean, that's the nature of the show, is I don't want anybody to see them, so I want them to hide. And because the visual effects shots are being done by numbers of different people, it's not, you know, with a lot of different skill sets in a lot of different places, you know, to kind of get everything done, it's important that we kind of keep that throughput. Now that we're into episode 6, though, you know, one of the things that happens is, you know, people start figuring out shortcuts and methodologies which allow them to do good work. You know, they allow them to do good, more efficient work. You know, it's not that they're doing bad work before, but it allows them to be more efficient because they learn it. They learn their shortcuts that allow them to get somewhere faster. And that's, you know, and that's sort of something that happens. But yeah, again, harkening back to Digital Magic and what Dan Curry did on Trek, it's definitely an influence. And on a show this big, where we have, you know, over 100 shots an episode, it's definitely the road that we're heading down, because it definitely benefits production when one team can be focusing on the creative and design aspect of a show while the next team is posting. So then they swap. I think that's like a brilliant way to do a big show like that.
Now, we actually spoke to Dan Curry last week, and one of the things he made a big point about was just how big a team effort anything like this episodic television is. Who are the principals in your team?
Raul Bolognini is our senior producer, and you know, he's an experienced, you know, he's experienced both in feature films and television, and he works with Trista Wall, who's our even producer, and they have a series of great coordinators, you know, Liz and Jack Smitten, they're on their team, and on the CG side, the Drive is managed by a gentleman named J. Rod Davies, who's, you know, very well known throughout the effects industry as one of the leading, you know, 3D supervisors, and he certainly, you know, he's won an Emmy with me, and he's been around here on Battlestar and Firefly, you know, since the inception, and to have him in charge of our cars makes me feel very comfortable. And Steve Meyer on the compositing side, who's, you know, a 15-year veteran of compositing, and having him sort of, you know, guide me as the guy who's out there on the set, you know, shooting kind of crazy camera moves that have to be put together in composite. You know, he sits there behind me and says, do this, don't do that, and I wouldn't, you know, be able to do any of this without, you know, sort of checking with him and making sure that, you know, we can fudge this, squeeze that, pinch that, roto this to get it all to work, and do it all, you know, within a 3-week post schedule. And that's really what it comes down to is, you know, we get 6 weeks, you know, before we deliver, we're given an outline, and then 3 weeks from there we get post, and then 3 weeks from there we're on the air. So it's pretty tight.
Yes, well, Steve's very well respected in the industry and sounds like a really good team. I know you're really tight for time, and I really appreciate the time you've taken out of your day to talk to us.
That's great.
We're looking forward to the later episodes. And is there an episode of the ones you've completed that is particularly a favorite, or is it the pilot and that 2-minute?
Well, it certainly is the pilot, really. It's because of the invention. It's because of coming up with that new Rubik's Cube, that new thing, and I'm excited for the effects world to not see it. You know, it's one of those weird things. It's like you work your kind of life in visual effects, you know, designing extraordinary things, but what's really fun about what we've done on Drive is we've created something that nobody in America will have any idea that we were a part of. And yet my pleasurable little secret is in our community. I hope that everyone says, wow, how the heck did that happen? So, and now, you know, we've let the secret out of the bag, and that's fine, because I want other people to say, oh, if you can do that, how about this? And if you know, that's where War of the Worlds started. It's like, oh, well, if War of the Worlds do that, how do you do this? And if you can do that, how do you do that? And I think that this video game language, this cinematic language that's kind of coming out of this omniscient camera, is something to really pay attention to. I mean, they did a little bit of, you know, kind of that gun POV in Doom, but I think that was like just sort of a touch on, you know, what's really interesting about video game cameras, which are set up specifically to allow you to understand the story of what's going on in the vision of the game experience. And so this is what, you know, our grand demographic of you know, 15 to 35 is used to. So they're used to seeing and understanding with complete clarity what's happening within the action. So you have Children of Men that's also thinking about this and putting this out there. Their techniques were, you know, executed using completely practical means. You know, that's the way they chose to do the same thing, sort of, that, you know, we're doing. You know, they have had a bunch of cameras on on top of a roof.
We spoke to the guys at DNEG worked on that, and also at the company that did the rig for the top of Children of Men. And you're right, it was a very, very good but practical approach.
Yeah.
But I think that it's, as I say, for me, it's really interesting to see this. If there was a signature aspect to your earlier work, it was this idea of CG cameras looking like real cameras. And now to see that you're doing real work with effectively a computer game camera for a different story reason, in both cases story motivated, I think is fascinating.
It's fun for, isn't it? That's just what you get in this for, right?
No, like, totally.
Exactly. That's what keeps us going and you know, keeps us awake at night, because we're trying to think of something different. So I hope everybody likes it.
We really appreciate you taking time and going into so much detail for us. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much, and have a great day.
Thanks, Mike, and thanks, Lonnie from Zoic, for taking the time to talk to us. During that interview, Lonnie mentioned the Red camera and also Dan Curry. If you look at the previous two podcasts we've done here on FX Guide, you'll see that those are the topics of those two podcasts. So if you missed those, make sure you check those out as well. For John Montgomery and Mike Seymour, this is Jeff Huser.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2006 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.